Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From our studios at KUOM, on the West Bank of the University of Minnesota campus, this is Culture Q, the art show that rocks. This week on Culture Q, the Rubik's Cube has been the source of both fun and frustration since the 1970s, but today has spawned groups of cubers looking to see who's the best. Brittany Hansen digs up Minnesota's anti-Semitic past, a story that could save a life, and much more tonight. So stick around, because Culture Q begins right now. First tonight, in the mid-1970s, the world was introduced to the Rubik's Cube, a frustratingly clever color-matching puzzler. New reporter Sarisha McMahon brings us a story about a new generation of problem solvers and a cubing community that's spreading fast.
You hear that? That's the sound of a Rubik's Cube. And different cubers have their own tastes in how their cube should please the ear.
I guess fast and clicky would be like my favorite.
This one is like smooth and kind of slow.
Okay.
So that's how I describe mine.
Only a smooth one, and I guess it has a scratchy sound too.
So generally a smooth cube. If it's like crispy and like really fast, it kind of irritates my hands, I guess.
So what is this cubing they speak of? And how did they get to know cubes so well that they form such exquisite tastes in them?
I thought it was crazy. I never thought I'd be able to do it before. The most I could ever do was a side, and then I'd start working on more of it. I'd just mess up what I had done, so.
That's Rob Northrup. He's a new cuber who started a year ago and hasn't been able to put it down ever since.
A friend of mine knew how to solve a cube about a year ago, and he taught me. And then about 4 months ago, I think, or 5 months, probably more than that, actually, I saw it sitting on the bookshelf, and I got bored, so I decided to pick it up and see how fast I can do it. And then I just looked on YouTube for more tips and saw all this cubing stuff. So that's
Rob's not the only one. The rapidly growing cubing community has others stepping up to the challenge.
Yeah, the internet is definitely probably the biggest part for speed cubing. That's like where all contact done is, and YouTube plays a big part with people posting videos of their solving, and that helps teach people other things what they need to learn. So the internet's definitely the biggest thing for the speed solving community.
Some, like Chris Olson, are so involved that they attend official cubing competitions.
I solved my first cube about almost three and a half years ago, and I've been serious since about the start of that.
Albert Yu says he's a little newer to cubing.
I solved my first cube 5.5 years ago, but I only got serious in speed cubing about a year ago, and I've only been in one competition, which was last November.
Albert Yu, a student here at the U of M, is talking about the fittingly named Cubetra competition that takes place here in our very own state every year at First Evangelical Church in Minneapolis.
For me, what I excel in the most is definitely 2x2. I've been trying to break the world record the past few competitions. I'm fourth in the world right now and second in the U.S., so I'm definitely, that's the event I'm definitely best at. And then for 3x3, I'm 110th in the world and 18th in the U.S.
Chris won fourth in the world? Never mind being able to solve a cube. People are using the internet to learn speed solving and compete with some of the fastest people in the world.
But they have like a speed solving forum where a lot of people around the whole world can communicate about cubing. And then there's also like smaller Facebook groups online that you can be a part of.
Trying to get faster.
Even though he's just started, Rob solves cubes every day, and sometimes he gets strange reactions from people.
People talking about trying to place bets on it. I've had somebody come up to me and say, you know, hey, I bet we could, you know, scam a buddy of mine out of some money. You know, we could bet that you can't do it, and then you do it, and you could get yourself some easy cash. So there's lots of interesting things like that. It's a conversation starter, definitely.
Okay, so cubing sounds fun, but what makes people keep doing it?
Well, for me, it's definitely like a stress reliever from school, because college can be pretty stressful at times. And if you solve a cube for like a set amount of time and totally just take your mind off of other things, it's really therapeutic in a sense, I guess.
I don't know, it keeps me thinking. As long as I'm thinking about the cube, I don't have to think about anything else. So if I've got nothing to do, rather than thinking about nothing, I can just pick up a cube and solve it.
And for those of you with a competitive streak, cubing is a type of sport for Chris.
Like, I don't ever want to put it down. It's just kind of fun to do, like a hobby. And I practice it like a sport, so there's motivation for me to keep going. And with people who can't solve it, they generally just get frustrated because they can't do it. So when you can do it, there's some sense of motivation to keep going.
Speed solving competitions aren't the only way to cube. Puzzles come in infinite shapes and forms, some that you can barely pronounce.
Your dodecahedrons, like the Megaminxes, the Gigaminxes, the next size up, and the Teraminx, and the Pentaminx, and then there's the Pyraminx, which is a pyramid shape. I have one of those too, and there's tons of different ones, so I really don't know how many there is, actually. There's just that many.
As a newbie cuber, Rob finds a sense of personal satisfaction in solving different kinds of puzzles.
First figured out how to solve a 3x3. I never thought that I'd be solving like the 5x5 or the 6x6, which is the bigger sized ones, and it just kind of blew my mind seeing those cubes. And when I first got into trying to speed cubing, I never really wanted to pick them up because they looked too complicated. And the more I saw videos on it, the more I wanted one. And
even one of the top three champions in the world says that cubing could be for anybody.
And I guess for whoever's listening, if you haven't tried it yet, definitely give it a shot. Like, just look something up online. I'm sure if you have a cube and you sit with it for a little while, I think you'll be able to figure out it's not as hard as people think it is. And that's something people kind of just need to get in their head. It's not very hard.
So for those of you who don't think you have the skills for cubing, even the pros say it's really just a matter of knowing where to find them. For Culture Q, this is Saoirse McMahon.
I'm Tess Weinberg, a producer for the show. This week, joining us in studio is our programming director, Kaylee Suhan.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining me, Kaylee.
Thanks for having me.
For those of you that don't know, South by Southwest is an annual week-long interactive film and music festival, which basically takes over the city of downtown Austin, which we learned when we were there. Mm-hmm. Kaylee and I both got a chance to head down there, and we want to share with you a bit of what we saw. So we're going to be counting down the top seven South by Southwest moments. All right, Kaylee, so what was number seven?
Number seven was Southern Sweetness and the general amazingness of getting to go down and spend a week in Austin, Texas during an extremely fun festival.
Yeah, it was really nice to just get out of Minnesota, and it was even better to go to Austin's like really, really cool city. Mm-hmm. So I definitely agree. Number six was the lines. So I can't really express to you guys how busy and how packed the city was, but we would literally be waiting in lines for hours to get into a show, and it really just showed us how big this event has become.
Exactly, because, I mean, everywhere you look, if you walk down the street, you see a huge line in front of this venue, and a huge line in front of this venue, and that's not even including all the people that are actually at shows during that time with all the different day parties, all the people waiting in line for shows at night. I mean, there's just a million and a half things going on.
Yeah.
And street performers to top it all off. So
yeah, definitely. I read that over 300,000 people came into the city.
Yes.
So if that gives you guys a picture. all right, Kaylee, so what was number five?
Number five was the really interesting performance spaces. I mean, we saw people perform in churches, in buses. Where else?
I saw Doomtree perform in a barn.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Grimes and Purity Ring and Charlie XCX all performed at the Pitchfork Showcase, which was held in a Presbyterian church, like right next to the altar. And so everyone was sitting down in pews and watching these performances, which I thought was kind of funny because it's impossible to not dance to that music. So
Right. It
was very interesting seeing people be very regal and calm during like such fun dance music.
Yeah.
And I was also able to see Charlie XCX do a Yours Truly session in a house that they had totally gutted and turned into a really beautiful performance space. So that was really interesting. Dion, another Montreal producer, performed in the back of the bus, like a big school bus that they had rented out, which was super cool.
Very cool. So moving on to number four. Okay, this was one of my favorite things. It was the food carts down in Austin. They're so good.
They were amazing.
Yeah.
There's Korean barbecue and so many tacos. I'm pretty sure I consumed my weight in tacos.
Yeah, I think my average was like 3 tacos a day.
Yep. I kept count and I hit 24 by the end of the week.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really, really good food. And it's real spicy food. You know, here in Minnesota, you get something, you order something and it's spicy and it's like not really spicy. But down south, if you order something and it's spicy, you know, your eyes
You're
and nose
cry.
Are going to be watering.
Yep. There was a hot sauce shop called Tears of Joy.
I saw that.
My eyes watered as I walked past because the amount of intense heat radiating from it scared me. The Minnesotan in me got terrified.
You got a little scared.
Yep.
All right, so what was number three?
Number three, Radio K was able to meet up with some really cool performers for interviews. We got to meet up with old-time favorites, Free Energy. Got to talk about Minneapolis a little bit. We interviewed Gold Fields, and those boys are just adorable and such huge sweethearts. We also got to meet up with Spoke with Thombo, who is so inspirational, as well as Naneka. We got to interview her in the back of the house that she was staying at.
Oh, wow.
Right next to a little playset, like on a playground. It was really, really adorable.
Aww.
But we got to meet up with some really inspirational performers and get some really great, like, South By coverage.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And you guys can check all of that out at RadioK.org.
Exactly.
Moving on to number two. Okay, this was my absolute favorite part of South by Southwest for me. It was the people watching.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most eclectic group of people I have ever seen in my entire life.
Yep, you have the business types, all the interactive people running around with iPads and cell phones with screens bigger than your face, that are basically bringing the world into the new technological phase. So you have all those people running around. Then you have the crazy musicians, all the tour managers, and just all the eccentric randoms,
yes.
I'll call them, that wander in and take advantage of there being 30,000 people on closed down blocks.
Yeah, and all the fans for all the different types of bands. You know,
mm-hmm.
I saw a metal show, hip hop show,
yep.
electro pop, other indie music. Like, the music down there was so eclectic. So, if you can imagine the crowd that was generated from this, it was it was matched.
And these
well.
Venues are right next door to each other, too. So, you'll have a hardcore punk crowd right next to a little twee pop crowd. And seeing those interactions and everyone just crossing street and waiting in line for tacos together is really adorable.
It was a good experience.
Definitely.
Okay, Kaylee, what is our number one South by Southwest moment?
Number one South by Southwest moment is getting to meet up with some crazy cool bands and have them record takeaway sessions for us. We had Big Deal perform in their house.
Oh, very cool.
And those two are so gall darn cute. We met up with Big Harp, and they performed in our hotel room.
Oh, wow.
Did a full plugged-in session, and we did not get shut down by the hotel, which cheers for that. We recorded The Pharmacy in their van out, like, in this big park. It was really cute seeing them all sit around the van and, you know, sing along with each other and exchange little smiles. Alligator Indian performed in their hotel room. Like, so hotel rooms was kind of the theme for this year, where it was just like, let's take advantage of this big, nice, open room. And they had quite the setup, which you'll have to check out over at RadioK.org. I'll just let you know there were Pokemon involved.
So if you guys want to see more South by Southwest coverage and Pokemon, go to RadioK.org. All right, Kaylee, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And those are the top 7 South by Southwest moments from this year. All right, now back to the rest of the show.
We live in an age of self-publishing, with blogs, Twitter feeds, and Facebook accounts to let people know who we are. But to step back to a simpler, more papery time, producer Noel Clark went around town asking if your autobiography were published today, what would the title be?
I think it would have to be called Red Bull and Jelly Beans.
Why is that?
Because that's the only way I can get all my work done.
Really, Ellie?
A great potential.
Be called Greetings from the Multiverse.
The Rise and Fall of Michael Gould. Or I Miss the 80s.
Can I think about it for a few minutes? Can that be the title?
It should be I Love Lucy, ghetto style.
I don't know, I'm a pretty happy person, but you know, I've gone through stuff, so I think dandelions and daggers. Because my life has been mainly pleasant, like a dandelion, but obviously there are things that one has to overcome in life.
Like and daggers?
Yeah, like daggers.
Beaches and bitches.
You can't say that on the radio.
Can't say that on the radio.
The Inferno.
Oh, mine would become...
Hey, what up?
Think of some clever play on words that includes your name.
I'm not clever. That's it.
Autobiography written today, what would it be called?
Think of your life so far.
Not done yet.
What does it take to eradicate hate? Antisemitism doesn't always reveal itself in the public domain of reality, but how do we do a good enough job of digging below the surface? New reporter Brittany Hansen searches for this answer.
Oh, oppression, you prey on us when we sleep. Oppression.
Recent violence in Toulouse, France, is seen to be directly linked to deep-rooted anti-Semitism. The people of France claim that anti-Semitic acts are usually non-violent and are often buried below the surface. How can such hate be hidden? And does the University of Minnesota have its own anti-Semitic tones hidden in its silver lining? Hi Berman, retired history professor of the University of Minnesota, recalls a conversation he had with a fellow colleague before coming to Minneapolis.
I'm leaving Michigan State. I'm going to the University of Minnesota. He said, to the history department? I said, yes, to the history department. He said, that's impossible. I said, why? That department is Judenfrei, free of Jews. He said, there's no Jews. Well, he was mistaken. They had already hired a couple before me, but that was the reputation it had.
Being among the first few Jewish professors here on campus, I wondered how High prepared future Jewish educators upon their arrival.
Well, I came into the history department in 1961, and of course the history department had already broken the barrier of hiring Jewish professors. Professor Bert Stein and Joseph Altholz were hired before me. So that part of it was the breakthrough. Nonetheless, when Alan Speer was interviewed for the position, I met him at the airport and cautioned him that there's still a kind of residue of resistance, and that as far as anybody's concerned, his family is the Speer family. To kind of hide the fact that he was Jewish.
Oh. There seemed to be an obvious tone surrounding the number of Jewish professors being hired on campus. But did the prejudice behavior stop there?
Well, the anti-Semitism on campus went beyond that. I did research later on and discovered that there was a network of administrators that were working to expose what they called communist Jews. The leader of that group was the dean of students, Nicholson, after whom a hall is named. He sent information that the spies gave him about different people to Colonel McCormick of the Chicago Tribune, the American Vigilante Society, and groups like that. And he got it all wrong, to be sure, because he designated as Jewish communists people who were Jewish or communists.
His personal experience proved this reputation, but did the Minneapolis community know it existed?
People should have known. Remember that Sinclair Lewis's novel Elmer Gantry is focused in Minneapolis. Of course, not called Minneapolis in the novel, but everybody knew it was Minneapolis.
My next mission was to find out whether or not anti-Semitism still existed on campus today. I met with Ofer Ashkenazi, visiting professor from Israel, to see how he felt about this very issue.
I hear a lot mainly by through speaking with students of mine, and some of the Jewish students, we talked a lot about how they feel on campus, if there is anti-Semitism on campus. I must say that most of them do not feel anti-Semitism. They do feel that they sometimes need to reach out, explain their position as Jews and vis-a-vis Israel and so forth.
I asked Professor Ashkenazi if he had heard that there was a history of anti-Semitism in Minneapolis before he arrived on campus.
You know, I heard that it was not always like this, but I know that today it's a pretty open campus where, you can't really see a lot of or violent or vocal anti-Semitic prejudice. Maybe it exists, right? I mean, I can't say that everything is great and always will be, but it's something that you don't, or I don't see, maybe.
We can look to Toulouse, France, to figure out that things are not always as they seem on the surface. So I challenge you, does anti-Semitism exist in your backyard?
You know, there's that saying that today is usually directed towards the heads of Facebook. If it's not broke, then don't fix it. Well, CPR has been the standard emergency rescue procedure now for over 50 years, and it's gone relatively unchanged in all that time. But a new method for certain people has come about recently, and studies have shown that it is saving lives. Just who it's for and who it saves, I found out in this story. Bobby Jo Swanson really had nothing to fear. She was only in her mid-40s, enjoyed running, and had no family history of heart problems. But earlier this month, she was saved by a new method of giving CPR after she suddenly started getting sick.
Like, really sick. Like, passing out, so sick. And I was texting my other friend, and all of a sudden, I guess my last text was, "I'm so sick, I feel like I'm dying." And basically, my girlfriend didn't want to leave me, but she had to go because she has kids and she had to work the next day. And so she called my friend Darren. He's like, "I'm just going to come stay in her spare room." And thank God he did, because I guess at 3 a.m, he heard me get up, and he said I was calling for him because I was throwing up again. And so he helped me back into my bed. And he said when he laid me down, my eyes rolled back and I started convulsions.
When first responders arrived, they began performing CPR. But not the 50-year-old standard of cycling chest compressions and rescue breathing, but a newer method involving just chest compressions.
Performed hands only, and it was Minx that got me breathing. He said he just did it a couple times, and I was breathing.
Now, there are a number of reasons why organizations like the American Heart Association have been advocating hands-only CPR over standard CPR in some cases. So this week, I attended a CPR certification class taught by Jennifer Lacey, who spent years as both an EMT as well as a search and rescue recovery member. And it's immediately clear why she's perfect for the job.
So I like dead bodies, and I recover dead bodies out of places.
After getting a blue squishy mannequin and practicing some chest compressions, it's soon revealed when and where hands-only CPR should be used.
When somebody goes unconscious, all the muscles in the body relax, including your strongest muscle in your body, which is your tongue. And when the tongue relaxes, it blocks most breathing in people. And so when somebody goes unconscious and you start CPR, if they don't do a proper head tilt to move the tongue out of the way, the tongue blocks the airway so people can't breathe.
So in most cases, hands-only CPR should be used by those who really have no formal CPR training. But there are some other cases.
I always tell people if there's blood or fluids in the mouth, they can do compression-only CPR if they don't have a barrier device, or if they don't feel comfortable putting their mouth on somebody else's mouth, and just do compression-only CPR until help arrives.
Now you're going to learn another part of CPR, opening the airway and giving breath.
And getting enough air is really important, because after 10 minutes without breathing, your lungs would start to collapse and brain damage starts to set in. In Swanson's case, she went 8 minutes without breathing before first responders arrived, leaving her with a grim prospect when she made it to the hospital and was put into an induced coma.
And then there was no movement or anything, so they were telling all my family and friends, if she wakes up, she's going to be brain dead. There was just, I mean, there's no way.
For Swanson, a single mom with her 8-year-old daughter, Anna, her family was left with decisions no one should have to face.
So they're finding out what they're going to do with Anna, asking my parents if I didn't, because I was single. I still am single, if they want to keep me on life support.
And even with the certified CPR method, coming back to life isn't always certain. Again, Jennifer Lacey.
I worked on a guy for 45 minutes. We got him back again, then we lost him again. Then we got him back again, then we lost him again. Then we got him back again, then we lost him again. Then we got him back again, then we lost him again. The whole way to the hospital, and even in the ER with all the drugs in the system, we couldn't get him to stabilize on his own, so the doctor finally pronounced him. And I felt absolutely horrible because we kept getting him back, but the doctor said we can't keep doing CPR.
But after learning how to use a defibrillator, how to give proper rescue breathing, and practicing chest compressions at a rate of 100 per minute, which also happens to be the tempo of the famous and fitting Bee Gees song, Stayin' Alive, I felt more confident that I could help keep someone staying alive if need be. As for Swanson, after 24 hours, she came out of her coma, miraculously without any brain damage at all.
And the first thing I said after I looked through at everybody's faces is, where's Anna? That's my daughter's name.
And it's had a lasting impact on her.
It definitely takes more time. Not that I don't take time with my daughter, but it's like, mommy, this color, or mommy, this. It's like, oh no, I gotta clean the house. Now it's like, you know what? No, let's go do this. The little things like that.
For Culture Q, I'm Mark Sheely. This week you heard stories from myself, Sarah McMahon, Brittany Hansen, and Noel Clark. Producers for Culture Q are Zach McCormick, Tess Weinberg, Mitch Skinner, and Noel Clark. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and host and managing editor is me, Mark Sheely. You can find us on Facebook and Tumblr, and if you miss something fascinating, you can always find recent episodes of Culture Q online at radiok.org. Thanks for listening, and as always, see you next week.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.